Thanks, Yingchen, for the very kind introduction, and thanks for inviting me to give this talk at PI. And let me just read the title. So today I'll be talking about what we call symmetry indicators for topological materials. And I'll begin with the acknowledgement. So it's actually a fairly long, so it took us quite a while to develop all this stuff, and many people were involved. In particular, on the top here are people more involved on the theoretical part of the project. And this row would be people who actually did all the actual calculations in terms of, say, ab initio materials prediction. And so it's really a great pleasure to come back to PI after a full decade, actually more than a decade. So I really want to show that I actually came here. The last time I came here was when I was a high school student. So there was this very fantastic program called International Summer School for Young Physicists, which aims at outreaching and then teaching high school students like relativity and quantum entanglement and whatnot. And to prove that I was really young, I even have a picture that I can find. And here's me there. So like that's me one decade younger. So let me just try to tell you the story about what I kind of recall about quantum entanglement when I learned it in PI. And this is really literally the place that I first learned about quantum entanglement. Maybe even this room or Alice's room downstairs, or either one of these two rooms in which we had lectures. So as far as I could recall, what I learned about quantum entanglement at ISYP 2008 was that it's basically about the long distance relationship between Alice and Bob, and also Carol and Dave and Eve. So there's a very complicated entangled relationship between all these people. And there are many sophisticated schemes to ensure that there's a good fidelity between them. So in particular, the really one example I remember very well is this canonical example of what is quantum entanglement. You say you have maybe two spin halves, maybe photon states, or maybe zero ones of occupation or something. And you say that you have something like a spin singlet. So basically it's like an entangled state between Alice and Bob. But then, let me just remind you that I was a high school student. So this is not the kind of physics or science that I learned back then. So let me tell you what I learned in high school, which are electrical insulators. Well, it's not even physics when this was taught in high school. It's mostly covered in chemistry. So what the kind of science we learned back then was basically classical. And they would tell us that, oh, you think of an insulator by having electrons being trapped in real space. They cannot move because they are trapped in some deep potential wells. And in chemistry, they tell you something, some more details, like maybe the electrons are localized because you form ionic compounds, or you share electrons between atoms and they form covalent compounds and stuff like that. So these are really the things I kind of knew back then a decade ago. So on the one hand is what I learned in high school, like basically classical pictures for the quantum world. On the other side, we learned about quantum entanglement. It sounds really interesting. So a very smart student would have asked, what happens if you have electron entanglement in an insulator? So I think this is really what someone, the participants of ISSYP should be able to ask. And because this is record, and for the record, I didn't ask that question, so I wasn't that smart. But today I will be focusing on this kind of things in which you ask, what is quantum entanglement going to do to our simple pictures of an insulator? And the natural starting point is to talk about phases or systems without that kind of interesting quantum mechanics. So the high school pictures of insulators are actually quite accurate for maybe a good fraction of the compounds that we know, in the sense that although you have quantum mechanics being relevant, but at the end of the day, the ground state of the system is not particularly entangled. So in this simple example, what we have here is that you have some potential wells, and each dot here is representing a pair of electrons, and let's say you just imagine them filling some orbital to spin up and down. So at the end of the day, you can write down your ground state as a product state over the real space basis. And on every side, you really have one state with two fermions occupied. So this is trivial insulator, as we would say. And of course, from the entanglement perspective, you can say maybe that's not the only way to get an insulator. And we have some non-trivial options in which your electrons are really not doing this kind of simple product state kind of insulating behavior, but rather maybe any individual electrons, if you insist, they have some kind of delocalized wave functions. But at the end of the day, the entire system is insulating and you cannot express your ground state as a simple product state. So this will be really what we call non-trivial insulators. Basically, if there's a robust reason why you cannot write your ground state as a product state, we'll say it is non-trivial. And the question I want to address today would not be really about the fundamental definitions of these or the classification, or the theoretical classifications of these non-trivial insulators. But I would want to pose a pretty practical question. So I want to ask, how are we going to predict and diagnose topological materials in the real world? So topological materials meaning things for which entanglement is important in understanding the physics, and you cannot think of it as a simple product state. So you may ask, why should we care about the real world? Or is it even intellectually a challenging question? And let me try to argue that it's pretty challenging. Because in the real world, you have this periodic table. Maybe you don't worry about the very last rows and whatnot, but at least some 50s or 60s of them are actually relevant for material science. So we have many options in terms of choosing the atoms in your material. And they can be arranged, or they can be combined together in a crystal in many ways. So in particular, if you think about three dimensions, there will be 230 space groups. So you can easily convince yourself that if I think about materials in the real world, there are many options for atoms, and there are many ways to combine them with different symmetry settings and analyses and whatnot. And there are easily more than 100,000 possible crystalline materials. So we really should ask, how are we going to navigate this real world the real world of materials in which there are many options or many combinations? And from a theoretical perspective, or trying to in the quest of trying to diagnose and predict topological materials, one strategy that one can use would be these kind of no-go theorems, in which you make some simplification up to the point that you can actually make strong non-perturbative statements about the options of the ground states. So here are some examples that we've worked on in the past, which are basically extensions of the Lipschitz-Mattis theorem. There's a discussion on what is the filling you need to get any trivial states in non-symmorphic crystal, and we have some extension for the quantum matter setting in point group. But this is not the strategy that I want to focus on today. The other strategy is to basically first simplify our problem, but then we can make more concrete predictions. So it's not really a no-go. It's not only a no-go, it's more like an actual positive diagnosis of topological materials. So the simple problem I'm going to focus on today will be really just free fermions in a crystal. And for those of you who have taken some classes on solid-state physics or condensed matter physics, then you've probably heard about band theory. So you'll say, my single particle Hamiltonian, I can diagonize the translation operator, you talk about different momenta. And we have some Fermi level, and the relevant physics is really controlled by the collection of single particle states below the gap, if there's a gap. But then we're even going to simplify slightly more, so we don't even worry too much about the details of the wave functions. Instead, I'm going to only talk about the symmetry data of free fermions in the crystal. So by symmetry data, what I mean is that you basically think about the global symmetries of the system, including spatial symmetries. And then at special momenta, you have these kind of labels, which is telling you how the block states are transforming under the symmetries. So this brings me to the idea of how do we define symmetry indicators, or what this really is. So the idea is that if you look at the space or the set of all possible band insulators, for instance, there will be some subset of it which is really trivial in the sense I've defined. So there's a ground state wave function which is compatible with having a product state ground state. So there's a subset which is atomic, and anything which is not trivial will be called a non-trivial by definition. But if you look at this kind of diagram, it's like a set, and it's very hard to analyze which is really why it's hard to navigate the real world of materials using just this particular diagram. And the punchline is that if you focus on symmetry data, as I will define more sharply later, then we see that this has a very simple group structure, and then you can actually make positive identification very readily using only some simple calculations and interfacing with DFTs and whatnot. So in particular, in computing the symmetry indicators, we don't actually need any a priori knowledge on what are the topological invariants that are possible in the setting, and we are not going to use any wave function integrals. But then I should emphasize that we're really trying to find materials or diagnose materials, and it's not going to give you a full classification. That's why we call it indicator instead of classification. So before I move on, I would want to say that we mainly developed these ideas in this particular paper, but then there was some contemporary work by another group which has kind of similar idea, but the formulation, especially the mathematical structure, is a bit different. So because I'm a PI, so I figured this may be a slightly more familiar language to some of you, so let me just very quickly go through this. So really, the program for symmetry indicator is the following. Let's imagine I have some classification of all the possible band insulators. In particular, it's going to be K-theory if you use that language. So we have some classification, which is generally an abelian group. And then we know that there will be some trivial subgroup of that. So first of all, it's always a subset by definition, but then it's also a subgroup, because if I have two atomic insulators and I composite them, the result is still going to be a product state, so it's still going to be an atomic insulator. So it's a subgroup. And having a subgroup, I can write it as this kind of terminology common in K-theory or that kind of discussion. So I can think of it as having the atomic insulator being included in a more general classification. And then you can do a projection, which is just a quotient. So this K-topological is really defined by this short excess sequence, which is this quotient that, and that's the topological. So that's the more standard K-theory kind of definition. But today, as I've told you, we're going to simplify it even further. So we are going to apply some additional function, which is called representation. So you just evaluate the representations, evaluate each of these, but then this relation will still hold. So really, the symmetry indicator is to say you look at the representation content of all possible band insulators, and there will be a subgroup of it which arises from atomic ones, and then you just do the quotient, and then you find indicators for having non-trivial band topology. So that's really like the more mathematical way of understanding what we are doing. But I would try to stay away from that kind of more abstract notion, but focus on mostly cartoons and pictures on why that should work. And before I move on, I'll just comment that in this particular general definition, you would expect that you need to know the entire group R band, which is the representation of all possible band insulators, and also the inclusion map from atomic to that. You need to know both pieces of details to actually compute a quotient. But one thing we find from this problem is that the quotient is special, and all you need will be really data in the atomic set. So that's kind of like a surprise that we found. So this will be the three main topics of today. And the first one is that, as I've briefly mentioned in the previous slide, what we found is that these symmetry indicators, they tell you when certain materials are going to be topological, but at the same time, they're readily computable, and all you need to do will be to analyze the trivial insulators. So that's a bit of a surprise. And I will talk about how we can apply these to actual material search, and reveals that actually a surprisingly large fraction of materials are probably topological. So the potential here is because the computational method is DFT at the end, and then it's known to be good, but not always good. So it really relies on further experimental confirmation to see how many of these are really having a topology we found. And then finally, I will try to extend all these ideas to the notion to the scope of superconductors. And interestingly, you need to find a proper notion of defining what a trivial state. So I will try to mention that at the end. So let me first start by really telling you how we concretely define and then compute the symmetry indicators. And to do that, I will need to first tell you more precisely what I meant by symmetry data for free fermions in a crystal. So the setup is that I will first specify the spatial symmetries of the crystal. So I give you some crystal, I know where the atoms are sitting, and they are related, different atoms related by some spatial symmetries, and the symmetries are really cataloged by one of the 230 space groups. But I also mentioned that if you have magnetic crystals, so you assume some of the magnetic moments are ordered and you freeze that magnetic order, then you have to also consider combination of spatial symmetries with time reversal. Like for a nail order, if you move by one side, you also flip the spin direction. So you need to combine the one side translation by time reversal to describe the symmetry of your crystal. So once you allow for those kind of hybrids between spatial and time reversal symmetries, then the number of magnetic space group will be 1,651. So that's really telling you how complex the material world is, because there's so many combinations that you need to worry about kind of all of them if you want to be holistic. So that's the setup. We will talk about some crystals, some spatial symmetries. And for our purpose, it's good enough to focus on some special momenta, for which the momentum is going to be invariant under some symmetries or some subgroup of the symmetries. So for instance, the gamma point, which is really like zero momentum state, then it's going to be symmetric under all the spatial symmetries. But then at some other point, maybe you only have a subgroup. So now once you're at some special momentum, you can talk about how your block states would transform under the subgroup of symmetry there. So more technically, you would say the block states would form some representation. So in this particular example, the special points are listed here along some lines, say gamma point, k, x, and gamma again, and the lines are labeled by, say, sigma and delta. So really, the block states will be transformed according to some representation, and in crystallography, they usually label it by some gamma, say, 1, 1, 2, 1, 5, or sigma, 1, 2, so on and so forth. But the representation content is really defined by saying I look at a set of bands that have a gap at all the high symmetry momenta. And then by looking at this particular set, as far as the representations are concerned, I'm really just looking at the count of representations. So for instance, for this orange box, I see that there are three bands here shown. And at gamma point, this is unfortunately cut, but then it's really gamma 1.5. So if I look at the representation count at the gamma point, I would say that there are three options, which are gamma 1, say gamma 1.2, which is not shown here, and also gamma 1.5. But of those three options, my set of bands only realize one of them. So there's none for gamma 1 and none for gamma 1.2, but exactly one copy for gamma 1.5. So that's really what I meant by representation content of my band structure. So it's really just a simple counting for some set of bands of interest. So I do this exercise for the gamma point, I find that there's only one copy of gamma 1.5. But when I do the same exercise for the sigma line, then I see that I actually have two copies of sigma 1. That's why I put a 2 there, but then one copy of sigma 2. So I have one there. And to get all the data, you really need to run over all the possible special momenta in the Brillouin zone. So that's why there are dot dot dots here. So you need to look at, say, also the X point and maybe the delta line and so forth. And in particular, let me reserve the last label nil being the number of bands. So there's also some data, which is like representation of an identity, just the total number of bands that I'm interested in. So in this language, when I think about the symmetry data of free fermions in a crystal, I already abstracted all the ways such that all I need to worry about will be a collection of integers. I just focus on some set of gapped bands and then I count, and that's all I'm going to do. So these integers, they form something like a vector. In the sense that if I compose, say, this set and that set, then the count would just add. So the composite of this band and that band, the total count would be just the sums of the individual counts. So they form something like a vector, and it's well defined as long as you have a gap. Because if your fermion energy is intersecting or dissecting some representations, then you don't know what the count should be. But as long as you have gap condition, it's well defined. And these are all integers, so we already know that this is something like an element of z to power d. So power d would be just the number of labels you need to keep to describe your crystal, or describe the free fermions in your crystal. But then we should also realize that not all of the entries in z to d are really physical. So here's one example. So remember, these are counts of representation. And let's, for instance, consider this entry in this group, which is some integers like 11, 27, 20, maybe 0, and 6, and whatnot. And let's say the last one is 1. So it's definitely an element of this Z to D. But we know that this is far from being physical, because this is saying that you have only one band, but then you have some more than 60 bands at the gamma point. So that doesn't make physical sense. So what this that is telling you is that although this is some simple group, a lot of the entries in this simple group are not a lot of entries in this group are not going to be physically relevant. So really, this object that I define as a representation content of any possible band structures, you should think of it as a subgroup of this much larger set, as like an envelope. So we need to find a way to find out what are the physical representation vectors. And as it turns out, the conventional definition is fairly technical. You need to talk about how the data or the representation data at different high symmetry momenta can actually all be consistently patched up with a gap condition and whatnot. So in the literature, these are called compatibility relations. And the real way of doing it is to say, write down all the possible compatibility relations and then solve all of them, and then you'll find the subgroup. And I will try to give you a shortcut. So instead of doing this, we'll see how this can be found in some alternative manner. And so first off, we need to realize that this is going to be not as simple as this simple counting. There's some subgroup, only focus on the physical part. But let me also mention that this will also contain negative numbers. And the negative numbers are not really physical per se, because it doesn't quite make sense to tell you that I have minus 10 bands. But then we're all going to keep them anyway, because we really want to keep the abelian group structure of it. So if you insist, you can say, let me also drop the negative entries. And then you don't get a group, it's more like a commutative monoid, which you can analyze, but it's a much more complicated mathematical problem. So we're not going to do that. Instead, we'll keep the negative numbers in our treatment. So this is really, at the end of the day, some subgroup of Z to D, which you know is against Z to some other power in general. But I've told you that we we are supposed to think about the compatibility relations, which are how different data can be consistently patched up in the Brillouin zone. But that is quite tedious. And instead, let's look at a simple class of solutions, which are the high school insulators I've talked about at the very beginning. So these are really the trivial ones. So the atomic solutions would be constructed by just saying, I think of my electrons being localized to points in space. And then I basically know immediately what is the ground state. But as a chancellor, you can also just evaluate the representation of any such atomic insulator. And being a manifest insulator in the real space will tell you that it will definitely be an entry of this more general set of band insulators. And the merit of doing that is that the atomic solutions are very easy to exhaustively study. So really the procedure is that you start with any given space group, and maybe you want to specify internal symmetries, like whether you have time reversal or not. Then we can exhaustively enumerate all the possible set of lattices. So technically these are called Wyckoff positions, but then basically you can arrange sites in different manners and still respect all the symmetries. And on any site, you can say there are some atomic orbitals that I try to fill, and the orbitals will transform in some ways. Let's say this is like a PZ orbital shown here, but then you can have SP, DF, or whatnot. So you really can systematically write down all the possible lattices in your symmetry group, in your space group, and then systematically talk about all the possible distinct orbitals. And once I give you this set of data, then this will be some atomic insulator if I fill all these orbitals. But then we know how to do Fourier transform. So I specify the real space data and I do Fourier transform. Then I will have some band structures and again special momenta. And I can really find readily how they transform under the spatial symmetries at the different momenta, the special momenta. So once I can do this step of Fourier transform, I now know how to do my counting. So I can translate this kind of data of band structures into basic account of saying I have one copy of gamma 1 and one copy of gamma 2, 3, maybe none for gamma 5, and then K1, K3, and so on and so forth. So basically what we can do now is that we start with some atomic solution for this problem of what are the possible representations of band insulators, and we can look at the set of all of them, and that will give me a subgroup of this larger group of all possible band insulators. And more pictorially, yep. Yes, so the dispersion is not relevant for us. All we care about would be, sorry, one slide back. You're right, so it's supposed to be completely flat if it's really tightly localized. But it doesn't matter if they talk slightly. What we want is that this set of bands will be isolated from above and below. And the dispersion we don't worry about. All we worry about is how they transform, how the block states transform. And the transformation of the block states are fully specified by these two pieces of data. So pictorially, this subgroup relation can be expressed this way. So this R band is actually going to be Z to some power, if you look at the previous discussion study more carefully. So in particular, let me show you an example with C squared. So I have only two directions. So this R band is really a mathematical lattice. And the atomic ones will be some subgroup of it. Or if you like, it's going to be a sublattice. So that's shown here as white dots. So these are really the locations in which if you do this analysis of all the possible lattice points and all possible orbitals, you'll find out that there will be generally a sublattice that is occupied. And whenever you look at this picture and you find a red dot, what that means is that first, it's an element of the possible band insulators, but at the same time, it cannot be any of the atomic ones just by the fact that it's not sitting in that sublattice. Then any band structures sitting at these kind of red dots would have to be necessarily topological. In particular, the symmetry indicator that we use this notation of XBS is really defined as a quotient group. So for this example, it's really like this unit cell here. So it's like C2 cross C2 in this example. So what is interesting is that if you follow the entire duration, although I gave only a very schematic view of it, but if you really sit down and compute all of these, what you found is that this indicator group is going to be a finite abelian group. So the abelian part is really following from how these are all abelian to start with. So this is fine. What is interesting is actually a finite group. So what that means is that the R band, like the set of representations of all possible band structures, they are C to some power. And the representations of atomic states are also C to some power. But then you can think of them as almost like vector spaces. But we found that they always have the same dimension. So this is non-trivial, and we had to show it basically by brute force computation up to some simplification, but then you really have to show it. But then we found that they are really having the same dimension, and because of that, then once you portion them out, all the elements are going to be torsion, so that's why this is a finite abelian group. And because in this language of thinking of these as vector spaces, what you can conclude is that a basis for the band insulator solutions, the more general set, is really constructible directly from just the atomic ones. So this is why after this thing that we proved, from this point onwards, there's no need to worry about compatibility relations, because all you need to know will be just the atomic solutions. And then from that, you can show generally what are the possible band structures. And so the punchline is that because of this result, to diagnose any topological material in any possible space groups or magnetic space groups, all you need to know are really the trivial ones, but you need to know them very well. You need to know the set of all possible trivial ones and their representations. But once you do it, you can compute this quotient and then find topological materials using this symmetry indicator. And let me pause a little bit by giving you some examples that may be familiar to those of you who follow the literature on topological insulators. So there's a famous criterion by Fu and King, which is called the parity criterion. So in two dimension, with time reversal square root to minus one and also inversion symmetry, what is known is that you have the product of the parities, that the four special points giving you basically the C2 index. And indeed, if you follow our framework and compute it, you will find in 2D, the symmetry indicator is C2. So that's really just the zero being the trivial state and the one being the quantum spin Hall index. But then if you do the same calculation in three dimension, the Fu-King criterion tell you that there will be three factors of C2 for the weak TIs, and then one additional C2 for the strong TI. But we found something different. When we do the calculation, what we found is that you actually find C4. So turns out the odd entries of the Z4, like 1 and 3, they are the usual strong TI. And the 2 in the 4 will be something more. So those are some actual states that were not realized back then in the Fu-King era, so maybe a decade ago, so it wasn't known back then. And what we found is that it's actually basically a topological crystalline insulator protected by both time reversal and inversion. And I will come back to this state later. But then let me just tell you that we've basically analyzed one group. And I've told you there are maybe 1,650 extra magnetic space groups. So it sounds all easy when you do a presentation. It's like, one group is one slide. 1,000 slides is doable, but forget that. So, but anyhow, it's actually an easy computation. So all we listed would be just the calculation results. But in fact, these can be computed on even my laptop in a few hours. So the merit is really that these are designed in such a way that they are computationally easy. And then we can compute all of these for all possible symmetry settings. And before I move on to talking about how we use this approach to find actual topological materials, let me just try to caution, because some of these could maybe a bit unclear from the way I presented it. So first off, let me just emphasize that we are not talking about a complete classification. It's not even like a complete diagnosis. So basically, we're only looking at the symmetry representations, and that's like partial information. So you can easily cook up examples in which you have a topological state, but then we cannot detect it using this method, just because there's not enough symmetries to detect what is topological about the system. So we have incomplete knowledge, but then these are still good insulators still good indicators in practice. So whenever we find that something is non-trivial using this framework, it's definitely non-trivial. So that's why we call it indicator. So anyhow, you shouldn't think of it as a complete classification, which requires some more refined approach. And throughout, I've used the notation BS every here, like here and then, like using meaning band structures. And you may wonder why I sometimes switch between band structures and band insulators. So there are really some details. So basically, we impose a gap condition only at high symmetry momentum, which is the places where you can actually find gapped or gapless behavior determined only by the symmetry data. But in general, you can have some irremovable gapless points at some generic momenta, and they would not be seen a priori using this approach. And that's why some of these things that I call band structures may be actually not like really insulating, so there's some distinction. But then if you focus on some specific settings, maybe these examples are absent, so it requires some further analysis, but just some cautions. And having introduced the idea, let me now move on to the question I really posed at the beginning, which is kind of a practical one. You want to ask, how are you going to navigate the space of all possible materials at least within the framework that these assumptions are good, like really quickly correlated electrons, for instance. So the real world looks like this. You have many complicated combinations. But what we are now going to do will be to kind of use the symmetry indicators as a filter. And you just pass all these down, and then you will be able to find materials in which quantum entanglement is really playing a crucial role in the properties of your system. So these are topological materials. And let me start with some examples. So this is one experiment done. The experiment is mainly done in Princeton with their collaboration between different groups. And then what they found out is that if you just look at elemental bismuth, so it's really just take bismuth atoms and then look at the crystal they form. So it was known that it's not a strong TI, but then it's only after this recent developments that it was realized, it's actually realized the phase of 2 in Z4 in this one, which is the one I mentioned. It's trivial under Fulking parity. But if you actually look at this symmetry indicator, you'll find that it has a non-trivial indicator. So what this phase is doing is that, in fact, the 2D surfaces are all gapped, so which is consistent with the statement that it's not a strong TI. But then you have these helical hinge modes that are protected by inversion symmetry. So this is really what they have found experimentally in some STM. So they have this like negative crystal in which they take a phase and then they find a way to get rid of some of them. So there's like a missing hexagonal prism. So there's like a negative crystal. So in this missing hexagonal prism, what they found is that you actually have these states that are consistent with having basically hinge modes going this way. This is what they showed there. And it's really how the fact that this one is non-trivial can be readily diagnosed by just looking at this symmetry indicator and realize that it's non-trivial. And more generally, you can ask how we can integrate these kind of theoretical discussions with actual materials prediction. And there's some flow chart that you can do. Basically, you start with the chemistry data, which is like maybe look at the space of known crystals that are synthesized in the past. And then you look at the possible atoms, and then you ask how are they arranged in space. And then you can do, say, DFT, or you can maybe just guess if you have very good intuition. You can ask what are the representations of the block states. And then once you know all the representation, then we have all the symmetry data. And then you can follow this chart to find different options. Maybe you can find semi-metallic behavior, or maybe you have a non-trivial indicator that is like a non-trivial state, or you can find cases in which it's not known to be topological using this framework. So this is basically the result of doing that kind of analysis in collaboration with a Nanjing group. And there are a collection of papers, and then there are also related works by other groups. So using this approach, we basically find new examples of strong TIs, or maybe these higher order TCIs, as well as the Dirac semimetals. And these are just some examples. And in reality, we found more than thousands of examples. Yep.
So in the example of inversion,
there's
only one inversion
point.
Why is there one
dimensional? Oh, yeah. So actually, that's a picture that you probably would appreciate. So the one, let's say I start with this. So this one is a strong TI. Yeah, I don't know why I write it here, strong TI. So now we talk about two of that, right? So this is really like strong squared, or strong times two. So now you should ask what happens if I really start with a strong TI and stack it with itself. So the strong TI has a surface Dirac cone, let's say here, but also there and there. And now I have two copies of it. So we know that you can write down a mass term. So you can gap this out. So with two copies of it, you can gap it. So here you have some mass term. And you can also do it here and there. So you have mass term everywhere. That's why we know that the surfaces can be all gapped. But then what we should ask is what happens to the mass term on this face and this face. So there are basically two options. So they're related by inversion. So inversion related. And you can see that they're basically of the same magnitude, but then up to the sign. The sign could be the same or different. So if the sign is the same, that is consistent with having basically the same constant mass term everywhere on the entire phase, then you just get a completely gapped phase. But if the mass related by a negative sign, so mr being minus m minus r. If this is true, then I can imagine deforming this to the sphere, and it's easier to discuss it that way. Then this point and that point have opposite mass term. So if I draw a line connecting these, then the mass term has to vanish at least one point. But then this is true for all possible lines that you can draw, right? So basically there will be a locus of zeros, which is inversion symmetric. So this there will be a line for which m is zero. So now, and when I deform this back to the cube, what you conclude is basically like the mass term could be positive here, but this phase is negative, and let's say that phase is negative, then you'll get this line of zero mass term localized to what is called a hinge. So this is really just the cubic version of this line of zero. So as you said, the inversion is going to leave only one point invariant, that is, and we are going to choose that to be, say, the origin of my cubic crystal. But then it's going to relate mass term on different phases, and that is good enough to give you these lower dimensional gapless modes. Yeah, so that's basically the general story for any of these higher order TI, like any higher order thing, you can basically understand it roughly this way, including superconductors. So back to this story about the actual material search, then what we found is that roughly 30% of the materials people knew about are actually topological in one way or the other. So that's kind of surprising, because although the chemists, when they synthesize crystals, they have many other things they want to look at or optimize, but at the end of the day, there's like a natural tendency to find interesting things. Or maybe in reality, many of the realizable materials are just topological. So that's kind of a surprise. And we can also use this kind of framework beyond just non-magnetic compounds. So this is one candidate we propose. And we believe this is going to be a Dirac semi-metal in the magnetic setting. And let me just point out that this is somewhat interesting because the magnetic moments are forming some non-trivial textures, like winding here and winding there. And even for twisted bilayer graphene, so we also did some work on trying to understand what happens in twisted bilayer graphene, which is when you take a monolayer graphene, stack another copy of it on top and rotate by a small angle, then you get this moiré pattern. And turns out even this is topological. If you look at the something like the Dirac point chiralities, then people found that they actually have the same chirality in the single valley. So that's not possible in any atomic insulator or any atomic states. So, but then there's a twist to this. Beyond the physical twist. So the twist is that this is not the usual form of topology, it's what we call fragile. So it doesn't technically fit into what I told you earlier on today. But let me just point out that Neugen also found this interesting indicator, which is if you have an additional mirror plane between the two Dirac points, then the statement that the same chirality is tied to the mirror representations along this line. So basically you want this texture to be mirror symmetric about this plane, then you see that they must have the same chirality. So we basically did this analysis, which is kind of a bit abstract and formal, but then I hope to convince you that these are of relevance to the real world material search. And in particular, we've applied it and found that like, really quite a large fraction of materials are really potentially topological. But then you may say like, look, these are at the end of the day, weakly correlated electrons, and they may not be extremely interesting if you want to think about more exotic phases of matter. So we can ask how you might extend all these ideas to maybe say superconductors, at least within the mean field treatment, can we say something? And that will be the last part of this talk, which is how we can extend that to superconductors. And as I've argued, then again, the real game to play here will be to understand the trivial states very well, and then the rest will follow. So the question we really need to answer is, what is a trivial superconductor? And one example is that you just have a boring insulator or maybe just a vacuum. So maybe I have, say, a 1D chain. I have something like a fermion, like just a chemical potential such that it, energetically it wants to fill every site everywhere. But then you say, oh, this is a superconductor. Don't worry about the U1 charge. So I just look at the fermion parity, which is still a good assumed symmetry. So in terms of fermion parity, you can say this is basically the same as the fermion parity on the site. And if you want to call this trivial, then you may be motivated to define trivial superconductors as like sum of commuting local fermion parity. It's like the direct generalization of what is an atomic insulator, which is like replacing the chemical potential by the fermion parity. But this is not a good definition, as many of you know, because of the following example. So it's the canonical example of a topological superconductor, which is the 1D Kitaev chain. So it looks slightly complicated in the complex fermion basis, but once you do the Majorana basis, at the end of the day, it's still some fermion parity, except that you pair the one Majorana at x with another at x plus one. So you can check that these are still commuting local fermion parities. So we know that this is a sum of local fermion parity, but we really don't want to call this one trivial. So that is really telling you that this previous definition is bad. It's not a good definition because it's not even properly understanding the Kitaev chain. And the story here is that you really should compare the physical realization with whatever is the physical Hilbert space. So the physical Hilbert space has a built-in grouping of the Majoranas, if you like. So we should really try again in defining what is a trivial superconductor, and let's do it a bit more carefully. So one way of doing it is to ask if my BDG Hamiltonian is smoothly deformable into the empty state. So the notation is that these are electron states and these are whole bands. So in the BDG formalism, you kind of just copy the electron Hamiltonian and then you have the whole band with maybe some hybridization. So you ask if you can smoothly deform the state to that state while maintaining the gap about zero energy. And if yes, you can say that this is a trivial superconductor. But then you also want to call the trivial insulators as being just a trivial superconductor because the pairing is unimportant there. So I really want to ask if the fully filled electron bands can be smoothly deformed into the whole bands or not. And in general, that's not doable when you have spatial symmetries. So if you're familiar with the case theory framework of these, then you know that this is deformable if you don't have any additional spatial symmetries. But once you instate spatial symmetries, then you start having obstructions for even doing this simple procedure. So a fully filled state cannot be smoothly deformed into a fully empty state in general with spatial symmetries. And to see why, we need to look into how symmetries are represented in this BDG framework or the Lambu basis. So you have the electron Hamiltonian, the whole copy of it, and then you have pairing. What is important is that the spatial symmetries, which add on the electron bands and whole bands in some usual manners, but then it can also talk to the pairing. Or in other words, you need to ask how your pairing is going to transform under the spatial symmetries. And it's basically some U1 phase that will show up. And if we, for simplicity, focus only on, say, spin full time reversal, then you see that this is going to be quantized to plus minus one. So basically there's a reality condition. So this is one or minus one. And this choice here is important because they can basically change the relative representation of the electron states and the hole states. And that's why you start to get obstructions for deforming the fully filled state to the fully empty state. And a slightly more concrete and familiar example would be to talk about inversion symmetric superconductors. So there, all these symmetry analysis, we're talking about the parity of your pairing. So we ask if delta k is the same as delta minus k, and if they are the same, then we say this is even parity pairing, and if they differ by a sign, then we say it's odd parity. So if you start with just a boring insulator, you have some bands that are filled, then I can imagine talking about the whole band corresponding to it. If it's even parity, then you should assign the same parities to the whole bands as the electron bands. But if you have odd parities, you actually have to flip it for consistency in these kind of commutation relations. So odd parities is really manifest here by saying that the whole bands will have opposite parities compared to the electron band. And once we have odd parity superconductor in this example, then the fully filled state, we just look at the parities below zero in the BDG Hamiltonian. You have a positive parity here band, a positive parity band here and a positive band there. But then the empty state would move the whole bands below zero and they are now here. So simply by looking at the parities, we know that they cannot be the same. So as long as I maintain the inversion symmetry throughout the deformation, I cannot smoothly deform the fully filled state to the fully empty state. So that is really telling you that if I define the trivial topological superconductors to the ones connected to the empty limit, that's the sensible definition, which is basically what is done in usual K-theory. But that's not the most physical definition, because that will start telling you that these states are supposed to be topological, which you really don't want to conclude. And therefore, the definition of trivial superconductors that we are going to use, which is basically inspired by these earlier works, is to say that a BDG Hamiltonian is trivial if it's smoothly deformable to either the vacuum or a fully filled state. So that's really just to say we want to say both this and that to be trivial states, although they may not be smoothly connected. And pictorially, there's a full set of all possible BDG Hamiltonians with your specified symmetries. And you want to say these empty bands or fully filled bands are all trivial superconductors. And let me just point out that, however, saying something is like a fully filled state is a really funny concept. It doesn't make that much physical sense a priori, because if I just tell you I have these two bands, then clearly by full I mean that both this band and that band is filled. But in any real material, you have infinite numbers of bands going up to the continuum states. So in any realistic materials, although there's a truncation at the bottom, so there's like there's a stop to the bottom, but then in principle you can include arbitrarily many bands above. So we really don't know what does it mean to say you have a fully filled system, like at least in terms of this physical problem. So the solution is, of course, that we are going to allow for any truncation here. Like that makes physical sense. Like any subspace of Hilbert space you can define, that's fine. But then the physical quantities you look at, it better be independent on the arbitrary truncation that we do. And that's actually a powerful guiding principle, as we will later see. So with that slight digression, let me go back to this problem of asking how we can detect obstructions but deforming my BDG Hamiltonian into maybe the empty limit here. So if there exists such a smooth deformation that we respect all the symmetries, then one necessary condition is that the representation content on the left have to be identical to those on the right. Because if they're different, then you must have some gap closing somewhere. So this is one necessary condition for this deformation to be doable. But it's only talking about the empty limit, and we need to worry about the field limit, like the full limit. But as you can see, it's almost the same slide. So all I've replaced is that instead of electron hole here, I replace it by hole electron. So we ask the same question, and the necessary condition is that the representations for the states below zero in your physical BDG Hamiltonian should be identical to the representations of the fully filled state. So these are these representation vectors B. And that's a necessary condition. And if I just combine these two, then the definition of a trivial superconductor will give you this necessary condition, which is that representation have to match either the vacuum or the fully filled state. But we can rewrite this by just a little massage of the algebra. Just move B vacuum from the right to the left. Then we basically say that a necessary condition is that representation vector minus whatever is in the vacuum has to be either zero or that of the full minus the vacuum. So it looks like just a trick, but then we can now reinstate particle hole symmetry, which wasn't kind of explicit in the discussion so far. So what we need to do now is to look at the full, the fully filled state of your system, and we look at the representations of the fully filled states, but then there's a particle hole symmetry that relates the minus E minus K state with the plus E plus K state. So you really have first that this band and that band being related by particle hole symmetry. And we also know physically that this is the electron band, that's the hole band. And the hole band is basically whatever is happening with the vacuum. So the statement is that B vacuum or representation of vacuum, you can find it by just applying the particle hole symmetry to the fully filled state. And once we know it, then the condition we've tried to derive would now be taking the BDG representations minus the vacuum, and we said that it has to be either zero or this version. But then we can try to do this quote unquote gauge transformation by adding to it some arbitrary empty bands, which are really there because of this arbitrary truncation in the empty bands. So by changing the way we truncate it, you basically shift your vacuum representations by some atomic vectors. And the BDG is also shifted in the same way because you add some corresponding states or some corresponding hole bands below the zero energy. So these are shifted in the same way. So the left-hand side is not affected by the arbitrary truncation that I've mentioned. But if you analyze the right-hand side, the full state being the particle hole conjugate of the vacuum would actually shift by the particle hole conjugate of this element. And therefore, if you look at the right-hand side, this is not invariant under this kind of transformation or this kind of redundancy. So if I shift this and that together, you actually pick up a non-trivial element in general. But we really want the physics to be independent of this kind of arbitrary shifts. And in particular, we can also observe that I might choose A to be identical to foo. So I can choose this to pair up to that and cancel it, and this will cancel that. Then this will become zero. So I can combine the two conditions into one simple statement. So the necessary condition for having a trivial superconductor in terms of representation is that the difference of your BDG representation and the vacuum, they should be basically some A in the atomic set and subtracting out the particle conjugate of that. So now we can redefine our notions of the representation groups. So instead of our band and just our atomic, we also look at these being the replaced version of the representation data for the general band superconductor. And the atomic version is replaced by this combination of A minus the particle conjugate. And then we can define the symmetry indicators by doing the same quotient. So the upshot is that by really carefully analyzing what is trivial, we realize that you should modify how you define the symmetry indicators for topological superconductors. And once you do it, then you can play the same game. So you need to worry about what are the parent symmetries for different space groups, and then you need to list all the possible options. And for each of them, you can then now compute the symmetry indicators, which has been done in this paper. And now let me end by giving you some concrete examples of what these mean. So the familiar example is again going to be inversion symmetric topological superconductor. So we, in particular, focus on only the odd parity case, because the even parity case will be trivial. And with time reversal spin-orbit coupling, you can do your calculation in different dimensions. The 1D answer will be C2 in the symmetry indicator, and that's the same as the Kitaev chain. The 2D answer, you find some stack of Kitaev chains, that's why you have C2 squared, but then you find a Z4 here again. So tensor Z4 can be understood as saying the odd entries are the usual analog of quantum spin Hall for superconductors. But then the two here will be a higher order TSC. So this one will have corner modes. And the analysis for 3D is kind of similar. You have the weak options like stacking Kitaev chains or stacking 2D versions. But then the top dimension will now be Z8. And the odd ones will be the odd entries in class D3. The 2 and 6 will be second order TSC with helical modes. And then the middle entry, the 4, will now be the corner mode topological superconductor. Or maybe you also have Dirac cones. So these are not generally, so you cannot tell just by from the symmetry content like which option is realized. So that's one example which is kind of understood before us. And then the other example that we found is basically if you look at anything with C4 symmetry and look at D-wave pairing, then you will do the analysis and find that in this case, the indicator is going to be a Z2 entry. And if you further invoke what we call weak pairing assumption, it's basically just the number of field Kramers pair in the normal state band structure. So the claim is that this non-trivial indicator would be either a gapless superconductor or is going to be the helical one. And the further analysis would be to ask what happens if you add inversion symmetry, and then some of them would be necessary nodal. So let me just end by talking about how this may be relevant for some physical realization of topological superconductors. And one picture is the following. So we start with some trivial three-dimensional material with C4 symmetry maybe. And by trivial, I just mean that I want something such as I give a surface states with maybe strong spin-orbit coupling due to, say, Rush-Rush splitting. But what is really key is that I have a control over the number of field Kramers pairs in the normal state band structure. So if this is the setup, then what we conclude is that as long as you proximatize superconductivity using some anything D-wave, then you would necessarily find something topological. So if it's gapped, you will start having these helical Marana modes at the boundary. Or if it's gapless, then you'll have these nodal topological superconductors with exactly zero energy states at the boundary. So you can play with the ingredients. Maybe you can switch this one to a 3D D-wave superconductor and some trivial 2D materials and so on and so forth. But then we can conclude very generally that this is going to be topological as a setup. So this is really what we gain from understanding the symmetry representations and the indicators. And with that, I'll end here. So let me just reiterate the main take-homes. So first off, we have this idea of symmetry indicators, and they're really readily computable as long as you understand the trivial states very well. And then they can be directly applied to finding materials as we've tried to demonstrate. And lastly, you can also extend these ideas to superconductors, but you need to have a more careful definition of what is trivial. And thanks for your attention.
So we have some kind of questions. So, regarding the definition of trivial superconductor. So what is, can you explain the, what the atomic limit of trivial superconductor look like?
Right, so it's basically, so the picture is the following. Let's say we start with a single site problem. So let's say I have a single orbital at a single site, and then I have, so I have the vacuum state, and I also have possibly the fully filled state, right? And then a superconductor will be, say, for instance, a superposition of these, that's like a possible superconductor in a zero-dimensional dot. So we know that this state is basically smoothly deformable to that for any alpha and beta, as long as this is normalized, then you can smoothly change any such, say, fully filled state smoothly deform it to the empty state, or for any other values. So this is really saying the all these are smoothly deformable to the atomic limit of having nothing. So that's what I call the empty limit. So that's one, that's the conventional definition of topological or trivial superconductors in K theory, for instance. The more general definition is that your HBDG has this electron hole form. And if it's deformable to having minus one here and plus one here, and say 0, 0, then that's the empty limit. Because the states below zero energy will be all coming from the whole band. So that's like the higher dimensional version of this empty state. So that's the conventional definition. And all I was trying to say is that that's not good enough, because if you have some states that are actually deformable to the field limit, so the negative energy states are really coming from the electron bands. So this is full or fully filled. So even for this state, generally, they are not deformable in the presence of spatial symmetries. So basically, this kind of deformation, if you add also inversion, for instance, then it becomes disallowed by inversion symmetry. That can happen. That depends on the pairing symmetry. So because of that, we really shouldn't define this as the only trivial states, but rather should define both this and that as options for trivial states. So that's why in the full classification, you have some, again, maybe some K-theory answer, and you want to look at the trivial subgroup. So in the usual K-theory, it's only one element, which is the empty state. Here we are saying you really should think about a subgroup of them, including also the fully filled states.
From the point of view of the empty state, is a fully filled state can be non-trivial
topological? Yeah, there's an obstruction for deforming from the empty state to the fully filled state. Right. So they are topologically distinct. But if I give you some material and I tell you that it's fully filled, it may not have any interesting signature anywhere else, right? So that's why these are topologically distinct trivial phases. And they are very common whenever you have spatial symmetries. So that's why you need to do all these symmetry indicators and stuff like that. It's trying to make sure that you really forget about all these distinctions between trivial phases if you want to expose the actual topological ones.
Then suppose I convert the spatial symmetries into some internal symmetries and use the crystalline equivalence principle and look at the topological response theories of these two, is there any difference?
Yeah, so in that discussion, if you really interpret the spatial symmetries as internal, then you have one unique trivial state, which is really, say, the empty limit. Then you'll say this is now really topological, but then it's protected by something funny because you really need to say that the translations are some Z symmetries in the system. So you can cook up some response, which are like the analogs of having a dislocation, for instance. So dislocations becomes like a more ordinary symmetry flux in the internal symmetry interpretation. But then these are really phases that relies on the topological, right, but they relies on having this Z symmetry as an internal symmetry. And that's not a very physical problem. Yeah, of course, a physical way to realize a Z symmetry is when it's a translation. But if you want to insist that it's internal, then it doesn't look very physical.
So for topological superconductors, do you have some example for S-wave superconductor?
Right. So I should say that in terms of the representations, you can show that S-wave meaning all these chi, like for instance, these kind of chi which relates the representation of the electron and holes. If all these are positive ones, then that's like S-wave. Then if that is the condition, then you never find any topological superconductor using this framework. So that's at least what something we can say for sure. But then now you can ask if there could be any topological superconductor with S-wave pairing, and with time reversal, for instance. I think there's probably none. There's something called the Anderson's theorem or something that forbids any edge states and whatnot, but I'm not super familiar with that. But then there may be some interesting discussion telling you that you should not expect any. But then if you don't have time reversal symmetries, you may have possibilities. Also, that's the picture of how you can think about the induced pairing on the surface of a TI. So actually you can put it in this framework and you'll find that they can be non-trivial, although the bulk is an insulator. So that will basically allow you to understand the induced superconductivity at the surface of a TI. So some mapping between the strong TI becoming like a higher order TSC in general. Yes, that's again very similar to this question Eugene asked. It's just that in the strong TI you have a Dirac cone, but then you double it in Majorana. So once you double, you can add mass term, and then you kind of generally either get rid of everything or you're left with a lower dimensional Gabbers mode.
Question. So, mm-hmm. One more question. So, if in cases where this bands form a projective representation, only, mm-hmm. then do you expect that you have a more?
Right. So one case in which you start having these projective representations. At least in crystallography, what is common is that first you either have spinful fermions, then maybe you have, say, C2X and C2Y, they commute as classical operation, is it rotate this way by 180 degrees or rotate that way. But then if you represent them on spinful fermions, it's like I sigma X and I sigma Y, and they don't commute. So that is part of the data you need to worry about in talking about this. So that's one option. And the other option is when you have non-symorphic symmetry. So basically the operation is to say you do rotation and then maybe you also translate by some direction, something like that. And then, so let's say this one and maybe TY, C2Y, maybe they still commute. But then if you have non-symorphic symmetries, generally you have possibilities that may be some S1, S2, S1 inverse, S2 inverse is going to be some translation in general. Then when you add on the block state, so you pick up some possible phase factor at different places in the Brillouin zone. So those are again some projective representations. So they, you can say they give you more interesting examples or they give you a lot of headache because you need to worry about the projective wraps of the symmetry groups and whatnot. But then all these, incorporated into the analysis already. So the statements we make are completely general. You can have any of these possible projective representations. They just change the symmetry setting, but then the analysis will just go through in the same way.
So representation with different, say, different phase factor, are considered to be different representation in your representation factor?
So the factor system is fixed. So you always pick one given. So let's say if I give you spinful electrons, then this will always be like that. Yeah, so you kind of fix the factor system, and then within that, then you still talk about different representations that are consistent with the commutation relations. Then they will follow in the same way. So at the point onwards.
So if there is no further question, just thank you.